The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns Gear and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain.
Good news, bad news. All those spam and text calls you've been getting lately? Well, that's a result of your information having been sold by third-party data brokerages, or it's been stolen and sold to nefarious people. Ticketmaster recently had a data breach where 560 million users' information was stolen and sold on the dark web. This included their names, physical addresses, email addresses, credit card information, and much more. Best case scenario, this just ends with more annoying phone calls and text messages. Worst case, it's going to end in fraud and you're really going to be in the hurt locker. That's why I've been using a service called Aurora for over a year now. I've talked about it on the podcast before, but not only do they monitor the dark web and the internet for my information in case it is involved in a breach, they go right to work removing your information from these data brokerages. When I signed up, they identified over 60 that had my information and went right to work removing me from these data brokerages. Now, yep, you could do this yourself, but each one of these data brokerages has its own policies and procedures, and I have no idea how you would even start trying to remove yourself from these services, let alone how much time that would take. But Aurora does that, as well as they offer a whole suite of tools to keep you safe, including a VPN, antivirus, password management, parental controls, and identity theft insurance. You get this all in one app, one place, so it's super simple. And you can do this with a 14-day risk-free trial. Super simple. And if you don't like it, you just cancel anytime. It's not complicated. At a minimum, you can take a look and see what information of yours is out there lurking on the web right now. Use the link down below in the description or go to aurora.com/afterburn and you get 14 days risk-free, cancel anytime, super easy, and take the first step in protecting yourself out there on the interwebs. That's the good news, by the way.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com.
Want to make a podcast? Let me tell you about Spotify's program for podcasters, and it's called Spotify for Podcasters. I've been using it for over a year now. Couldn't be happier from the Switch. You can record wherever you create podcasts, whether it be your phone, computer, and it's easy to upload it and distribute it to everywhere podcasts are heard. With Spotify for Podcasters, you can earn money in a variety of ways, including ads and podcast subscriptions. Best of all, Spotify for Podcasters is completely free. So launch your podcast today. Get started with Spotify for Podcasters. Go to www.spotify.com/podcasters to get started. The Afterburn Podcast is brought to you by Bogey Dope. Interested in a career in aviation, whether that be the military or civilian aviation, Bogey Dope has the instructors. They have the courseware to get you started and launch your aviation path. Click the link down below and you can use the code Afterburn for 5% off.
Be advised, the restricted 6002 is still active. Next,
16,000. Welcome and thanks for listening in. My guest today is Croc, who is a Viper driver and the president of Guns Gear Memorial Foundation. Rick Guns Gear was an F-16 pilot. He was a weapons instructor at McIntyre Air National Guard Base, and unfortunately, in July of 2020, he passed away. Several of his squadron mates, like Croc, friends and family, came together to found the Guns Gear and Memorial Foundation. They have two objectives: to help veterans and get youth involved in aviation. They were kind enough to invite me and E3 Aviation Association up to their annual golf tournament, where one, we were able to meet a lot of the people that are helping, which is very cool to see and humbling. And then two, capture a lot of stories about who Guns was, what the foundation is doing, So over the next few weeks, you're going to hear several podcasts about the Guns Garand Memorial Foundation. Another aspect that I'm really excited about is E3 Aviation Association. We're launching here in the next few weeks. And if you've been following me on social media, you probably have seen me post once or twice about E3 Aviation Association. Well, right after our launch, we're rolling into Sun and Fun, which is the second largest air show in the country and a phenomenal air show at that. And we're excited to be the title sponsors this year at Sun and Fun. Guns Garand Memorial Foundation, they're joining in with us. A portion of the proceeds go directly back into the foundation to help veterans and to help youth get involved in aviation. You can click the link down below. You can join us. There are a limited number of spots. It's an air-conditioned chalet that you'll have access to all week. Food, beverages. The exciting part, we're going to have tons of guests rolling through for live Q&As, meet and greets, etc. From Mustang pilots, F-35 pilots, F-16 pilots, mechanics, airline pilots, and everything in between aviation. So you don't want to miss out. Again, you can click the link down below. Join us at Sun and Fun this year for a VIP experience. You won't regret it. Again, a portion of those proceeds go directly back into the Guns Garand Memorial Foundation. So check that out down below. With all that being said, let's jump into the episode with Croc.
Dude, Croc, thanks for joining me on the podcast, man. It's good to have you here. We got a whole series coming about the Guns Garand Foundation, but this is a little bit more about you and obviously how you tie into it as well, because you're going to be quite active when the podcast series drops, when we did up there at Fort Jackson. This is not a trap. This is going to be the first and only time probably in your Air Force career that when someone says, tell me about yourself, I really want you to tell me about yourself. So can you kind of give me the 60 to 90 second elevator pitch of who you are, a little bit of background?
Yeah, sure. We're excited to be a part of what you're doing, Rain. So thanks right off the bat for hosting GGMF at the golf tournament on your podcast and helping us get the word out with what we're doing through the foundation. But a little bit, I think what we can tie together today is a little bit of like the journey that brought us to the point which we captured like last week in that podcast series. So like you said, my name is Croc Atherton. I grew up in Texas, joined the Air Force, went through the Air Force Academy. I commissioned, which I know you'll probably promote that more than anything in this entire series, right?
Yeah, I mean, actually, we could stop there. So I think we're good. We got everything we need. Thanks.
Yeah, exactly. Dude, and really, that was kind of the start to where we're at today, which was, you know, from there going to pilot training in at Laughlin. That was in 2009 into 2010. And then from there stayed as a T6 FAPE. So I guess we share that in common. We're both FAPEs.
Winning.
Yeah, exactly. And that was
definitely,
that was like an interesting time in the Air Force. Well, I guess everything's an interesting time when it comes to the Air Force, but it was like when fighters were at a premium, and it was probably a blessing in disguise to sit in a holding pattern there for 4.5 years while I waited to figure out what was going to happen next. From there, we transitioned into the F-16 to fly the Mighty Viper. Went to Luke Air Force Base, which was an absolute blast, and then had the privilege of going out to McIntyre, where I've been since up until this last year. So I spent quite a while out there, and now at 10th Air Force back here in Fort Worth. So kind of moved back to where I grew up. So,
yeah, that's a good journey. But I was going to say, it's kind of amazing that they sent you to McIntyre as a FAPE. And I know that wasn't in the calculus. I wonder today, or at some point, I think that has been in the calculus, being a dude who's senior, who then at their end of the pilot training commitment is pretty close to moving from that first assignment in the Viper at McIntyre, where you can get out and separate and become a guardsman there.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it is a lot in life, just luck and timing a little bit. Right. And you know, if you would have told me that when I was sitting in Del Rio, my first year as a FAPE, I would have been like, dude, there's no way. Like my Air Force career has already started like, without any luck, you know, like I have to teach kids how to fly for 5 years in Del Rio, but it ended up working out great.
I want to back up real quick. What led you to go want to be a pilot and want to go into the Air Force?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I grew up, I've, you know, a great mom and dad. My dad served 22 years in the Air Force. He was a crew chief on F-4s and then on F-16s. So I can remember as a kid going out to the, you know, the line shack and just watching Vipers at Misawa take off for, you know, like a night ball. I was, yeah, probably 6 or 7 at that time. And just seeing that, I was like, dude, this is what I want to do, man. This is freaking awesome. And it's weird because, you know, one of the tails that was actually at Misawa at that time before they transitioned to Block 50s, they moved back into Luke, and I actually flew that same tail in the B course, like one of the same tails that had been there. So it could have been one of the jets I'd seen like growing up as a kid.
That's always cool to hear those stories. You know, if you're surrounded by it, the PK, the probability there is usually a little bit higher that you might get bit by the bug, or make a flip side, like you want nothing to do with it. So it's cool to hear that lineage.
It is definitely a lineage. My grandfather was in the Air Force. You know, my dad was, grandfather on both sides served in the military. So, you know, I think there's something where you're constantly being raised and like, you know, bred into a sense of service. It's, you know, it's something that is being instilled in you, so to speak, at a young age, you know?
So you obviously were surrounded by it, but there's a lot that happens between being like, hey, that's pretty cool, and wanting to figure out one, how to go do it, and then going to do it. Like, when was it, did it really kick into gear that, hey, I want to go to the Air Force Academy, and you started figuring out all the requirements to do that? What was that like?
Yeah. So when I was in high school, one of the teachers that I had, her husband flew with the SPADs out here in Fort Worth, K-Squared Knudsen, for those of you that know him. So he showed up one day at school to like pick up his kids. And I like walked up to him, I think it was like a freshman in high school. And I'm like, dude, like, what do you do? And he's like, I'm a Viper pilot in Fort Worth. Like, who are you? And I'm like, dude, like, I want to like have that same job. Like, I want to be you one day, basically. How do I do that? And so he's really like, you know, I still talk to him quite frequently today. He's been a mentor ever since then. And he went on to do great things, but really he was the one that said, all right, dude, step number one, like, you're going to apply to go to the Air Force Academy. If you don't get in there, you're going to go to, do ROTC. Like, that is your best shot at becoming a pilot. And so he kind of gave me like the different options, and I kind of just followed his lead, man, like every step of the way.
Dude, having a mentor is key. And that's what, you know, I've tell a lot of guys who or gals who want to go pursue this, but, you know, find someone who has done it, right?
Sure.
And then lean on them. Hopefully they'll bring you under their wing and guide you kind of through the process. So don't go with someone through. But another thing too, not that, I mean, the internet was obviously around when we were going through doing this, but it was limited. You know, you're not doing applications online. Yeah. I think the resources were still limited. YouTube existed, but, you know, now the amount of information that's out there, personally, and this, I should be better about it, but I'll get asked a lot like, hey, how do I be a fighter pilot, or how do I become a pilot? How do I join the Air Force? There are some like basic questions and answers out there that you can find. And so when you find a mentor, like, hopefully you've done a little bit of prep that have some of the basic questions, and there might be some nuances that you need to get some guidance in there with, but there's so much information out there that you can gather alone. What advice, am I off the reservation, or do you have any advice for someone who wants to go do this?
Yeah, I mean, we deal with that like in the foundation a little bit. I mean, that's one of the pieces, is where we're trying to inspire like the next generation of pilots. And really that's the education piece. So like my advice to anybody who's interested in getting serious about it is like, number one, like if you're in at the high school age, like, give yourself options. Like, that was the biggest thing that K-Squared and really there was another really good mentor of mine, Tang Garfield. They were like, do you always want to have options? And so the way that you set yourself up to have options is you apply yourself and you succeed with where you're at, and that gives you options for the next step. And so it was the same thing that I carried into pilot training. from after graduating at the academy was like, the only way you're going to have the option to be a fighter pilot is like to do well in pilot training. And so succeed at where you're at, and that gives you options for your future.
Yeah, I've always heard the term, you know, be the best at everything you do, which is easier said than done, but, you know, lay it out on the table, and like, you have to win if you're going to be competing at that level. It's a long road. The other piece too, that I think I'm similar to you, early on, I was fortunate, right, to get surrounded by aviation and know this is what I want to go do. And I know you mentioned something of the foundation that most kids aren't getting exposed to aviation through the study you guys did, like, until late high school. But really, if you're going to go to the academy, if you're going to do ROTC, like, you can join ROTC kind of late sometimes. Again, it depends on the year and what's available. But really, it's those years like late middle school, high school, where you really have to be setting yourself up for success, good GPA, extracurricular activities. So the runway starts getting short pretty quick. And I know you're at McIntyre, and people get hired to fly fighters or planes, period, at Guard and Reserve units across the country late in the game, like in their early 30s. But that's pretty rare. Like, the runway starts running out fairly quickly. And I think if you blink, you don't really realize just how fast it can go by.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, that's definitely something that that they both taught me as well. Those two mentors was like, don't convince yourself that you're out of the fight. Like, you know, don't take yourself, like, show some adversity within and determination within what you want to do in life. And don't convince yourself too early that you're actually out of the fight. Keep fighting. So, you know, there were definitely times throughout my career where, you know, like, it's like, dude, you're not going to be able to do this. And it's like, I would call those two bros and be like, hey man, like, I don't think it's going to work out. And they would be like, yeah, it is, dude. Like, you're going to let one dude who says no convince you that you don't want to be like a fighter pilot. And I'm like, well, good point. So there's different, you know, it's like, too often you see kids or they're really like college age, you know, young adults, they're convinced like, no, man, this one recruiter told me no, so like, it's never going to work out. Or like, this, you know, I have bad eyesight, so like, I'm, you know, it's never going to happen. And it's like, dude, you got to, if you want it, you got to be determined and fight for it.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I actually had someone message me yesterday saying they were pursuing the Navy because the Navy recruiter is more receptive. They want to be a pilot, kind of going down that path. And I worked with recruiters for quite a while, you know, my last part of active duty career, doing the demo piece and then in the reserves. And I think people have to realize that, one, if you're an outsider trying to get on the in, you're trying to figure out what the battle space looks like, which for a recruiter, I mean, predominantly they're worried about hitting their end of the month numbers. Like, that is just a fact of life. So if you're not a solution for them to hit their end of the month numbers, get the number of, you know, boots into basic training, you're not really solving their problem. And while they have limited amount of resources and time. So sometimes right place, right time, you know, you get the right recruiter who can help you out. But yes, like, don't take no for an answer. Like, there's always a path. And if you want it, like, you really have to go out there and figure out how to get there, because again, no one cares about your career more than you do. So, you know, if you're going to sit idly by, that's the result you're going to get.
It's interesting that you would bring that up. So like, one of the things that it's funny looking back, like, K-Squared and I, we laugh about this, dude. I'll tell you this quick story, and it's hilarious, like, looking back. So it's my junior year of high school. And he has me over to his house for dinner, and he goes, dude, I want to pitch something to you, and you need to go to your high school guidance counselor and convince her that this is a good idea. I'm like, all right, what do you got? He's like, dude, you're going to do an internship at the fighter squadron. And at the time, he was the fighter squadron commander. He's like, you're going to do an internship at my fighter squadron and come, like, work for me. And I'm like, an internship? Like, normally, like, you do an internship, like, you're going to get hired. I'm like, dude, I'm like 15 years old. Like, what? He's like, no, man, like, what we're really going to do is, you're going to sit in the bar, you're going to make corn, you're going to make coffee, and you're going to talk to every single one of the dudes that flies for me. And you're going to figure out, like, what their background is, what their story is, how they, like, got to where they're at, at this point in life. And it's going to give you perspective at a very young age of all the different ways you can do, like become a fighter pilot. But it's also going to help you understand like what the culture is like a little bit more. And so I went to my guidance counselor. I was like, hey, like this lieutenant colonel wants me to like internship for like the Air Force. And she's like, oh yeah, that's awesome. So I had every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, all the afternoon periods off. And I'd drive out to the fighter squadron. And I, as a 15-year-old kid, dude, I would just sit in the bar like and make corn and coffee all day long. I would like clean the bar. Like I can remember like dudes walking in and being like, who are you? Clean the bar, dude. It's like gross in here. So I was like, you know, like
that's
it
awesome.
Was great, man. And like over time, I did that for a whole entire year. Over time, like I got to like become friends with these dudes who were experienced fighter pilots, and they'd just gotten back from an Afghanistan deployment. So I got to hear like a lot of those stories, and that like internship or that experience really is what it was priceless, man. I mean, like 15-year-old kid hanging out in a fighter squadron for a year. It was awesome. You know, you got to see how everything That's worked.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah. It was cool.
Well, and the fact, I mean, yeah, you nailed it with a bunch of mentors and just being a sponge, soaking stuff up in the environment you want to be in. That's pretty fortunate. Again, like K-Squared, having a guy like that who's willing to take you under his wing and essentially go to bat and make things happen for you is pretty huge. Not everyone has that, but still, like, it didn't just fall in your lap. And that's the thing, the important piece is you went out and put yourself out there and made the effort and showed the dedication, showed like that you wanted to go do this. And I think by doing that, showing up and not just trying to, I guess, have someone else do everything for you. People want to help people out who are passionate and want to go succeed and try and do something hard, I think. Well, all right. So, man, you go Air Force Academy again. I know that's probably the highlight of this podcast episode, especially when we get Baldy on his episode. Maybe we get you guys together and you can just talk Air Force Academy stuff. I don't even know what you guys do up there, but Laughlin. So, you know, you and I both FAPES, First Assignment Instructor Pilots. Again, for those who just love the acronyms, I think you hit the nail on the head. It was kind of a blessing in disguise in that time period, at least. It ended up being that way because fighters were really limited. So having another, I guess, swing at the bat there was pretty helpful. How was your time in old Del Rio?
I mean, looking back, it was, you could find good parts about it. I mean, Del Rio is like kind of a, for those who don't know where Del Rio, Texas is, it's right on the border as far south in Texas as you can go. And it's like a good solid 4 hours from like anywhere like humanity.
Isn't the base right there on the border? Like you have to be careful not to fly into Mexico.
Yeah. The VFR arrival, if it's still the same, I haven't been there in a while, but like you fly down the Rio Grande, is like you leave the airspace and you basically like fly until you hit the river. And as a student, you're like, dude, I hope this is the right river, you know? Cause like, you don't know what's going on and you fly down the river until you get to the traffic pattern. It's right on the border. Looking back, it's like one of the, you know, like Baldy and I, we laugh about it. It's like, dude, we want to like go meet the dude who came up with the concept of a first assignment instructor pilot, because it's like one of the most, it's the coolest thing you could do. Like you have very little responsibility other than to like teach basic flying, which, you know, for your bros that are going out that are graduating pilot training, that are learning like weapon systems and how to employ the weapon system. Like you're doing something that's like, it's challenging because it's a lot of work and there's a lot of throughput, but at the same time, man, like the Air Force has given you that asset to like, to do basically like, you go cross country on a weekend and you're like, oh, well, see you guys. Like I just graduated pilot training 2 weeks ago. I'll see you like next weekend, you know, like thanks for the airplane.
Yeah. I mean, you as a first lieutenant, you know, you could be what, 24, 25, and then you have a brand new lieutenant going through pilot training and they give you $4-6 million asset to just go wherever. I found you have a lot more, you have a lot of responsibility that just kind of gets chopped off to you versus going like, not, you go to the Viper route of the course, like you have a lot of responsibility. You got a big asset, a lot of learning the weapon systems. It's still, it's obviously the same, a lot of responsibility, but yeah, it's just, it's unique in that sense. It would be interesting to hear the concept behind that. And I'm sure it's purely just based on numbers.
Yeah, I think one of the things that teaches you how to do, like really young, is how to make, young in your flying career, is how to make decisions like pretty quickly. Because, you know, if you're a young wingman and they show up to a fighter squadron, like, yeah, you're going to make a couple like small decisions. But at the end of the day, you're like a wingman in a four ship, and there's like an IP that's going to tell you what to do. And you got to figure out how to like execute it. As a young instructor pilot, it's like, dude, you're the only one that's going to like make the decision for yourself. No one's like telling you what to do. And so I thought that was a really valuable lesson that I learned like young in my flying career, is like how to be decisive and like, well, we'll hope this is the right decision. And if it's not, like, I'm gonna have to figure out how to fix it.
Yeah. You get handed the leash pretty early there. And I think that's a good point with it, because yeah, it's usually just you versus, you normally would have two flight leads or instructor pilot in the formation, and it could just be a bunch of FAPEs out there, a bunch of young lieutenants raging around the country dealing with weather or emergencies, et cetera. So it's kind of cool. Again, it's not like, I think is putting it down as their first choice to hang around and teach pilot training, but it ended up being a pretty good experience for me. I think Columbus, Mississippi might've been a slightly better spot, not quite there on the border town, but you know, to each their own.
No one's picking it, but I think it ends up turning out all right.
Yeah, I think it gives you airmanship. You can rack up the airmanship a little bit faster because you're flying nonstop. I mean, I think probably your first year as a FAPE feels like you're probably at least double turning, if not triple turning, a few times a week. Like, or you're double turning every day, and then you might triple turn a couple times. You really get to rack up the hours and go out there and do it. Did you guys have the ALP program, that aviation leadership program, with all the foreign national students at Laughlin?
We did, yes.
Or was that just...
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you get to experience some really good stuff with some ALPsters going through?
Dude, we were going into... This is... Actually, Baldy and I were on the same cross country. We had this idea that we were going to fly from Del Rio to Phoenix, which doesn't seem like it would be that far of a flight, but it actually is an extremely far flight in a T6 when you can't cross into Mexico. So we're both with Saudi students, and it's just a challenge, man. Like, you're not speaking the same language. I would say like there's probably like some like differences in how they're understanding like instruction and things like that, like different cultural barriers. And so it was hilarious. We're on the ground in El Paso getting ready to do our second leg to Phoenix, because we just want to like go hang out and party in Phoenix. And I'm like, dude, I'm worried about going into this like Class B airspace with these kids, because they're horrible like at talking on the radio. And Baldy's like, he's like, dude, let's just give him like, let's tell him like, you've got one radio call, like one radio call. And if you screw it up, like, we're taking the radios. And dude, I'll never forget it. We're both in line to shoot the ILS into Phoenix International. And there's like probably 69 Southwest jets and American jets, you know, 737s trying to get in. It's their arrival window. So they've got like probably six downwinds to then go to like six doglegs to final. And they're just joining people on the visual. And so the controller, this is his first radio call in Class B airspace. The controller goes, you know, whatever our call sign was, Texan, you know, 01, do you see the 737 in front of you? Follow them, clear the visual, runway 26 into Phoenix. And he goes, yep, I see him. And I'm like, I look over the intercom, I say, like, which 737, bro? And he's like, well, yeah, I see like 10 of them. And I'm like, so which one are you going to follow? And he's like, I don't know. That's a great question. So I was like, oh my God. This is like where you don't want to be in your life right now. I ended up working out.
I, so. Yeah. Well, yeah. Look at you now. I mean, look where you've gone and just sitting here like a champion. I don't think I ever went into the busiest place I went into was Nashville. And I definitely remember my student, Ryan Parrish, great dude. He's still out there. Always a great dude. The controller was not happy with him. Like, we're on this ILS at night, just completely gumming it up for, you know, probably five jets they have on arrival there. And the controller's like, well, I'll see you next time. And he's like, oh, see you next time. I'm like, you're not picking up. That guy is really not happy with you right now. And for those in the aviation world, you probably can figure that out. But I've heard stories like, you guys always like out west, Del Rio and Vance going into Phoenix Sky Harbor. My buddy popped the tire on the runway there, which I don't even know like what the madness that probably caused and ensued for ATC. I'm surprised they let Air Force jets still go into Sky Harbor.
Dude, it definitely makes them mad. Like, looking back on it, I'm like, dude, that was like one of the dumbest choices I've ever made in my life. Like, that is probably got to be one of the busiest airports in the country. I can remember that same time we landed and like the controller is like, exit next taxiway. And the student's like, yeah, I'm going to do it. I'm like, like, hell, you're going to do it. Like, dude, we're still going like 100 knots. You're not going to try and like get off on a high speed taxiway, so to speak. I mean, it was dumb. Like, it was really my fault. Like, it was stupid to even go in there.
Well, yeah. So they can't stop you from doing it. It's just ill-advised. But T6, I mean, I don't know. What were you doing? Like 110 knots? I don't even know what you shot the approach at on T6. I don't remember that. But
I'm trying to forget all that.
Most big airport. Yeah, that Penguin fell off the iceberg a long time ago. But I mean, most big airports, they want you like 180 knots, 170 knots to the final approach fix. And while you can do that in the T6, if you have a international student who's not really well-versed and it's his first like cross-country, it's probably not the time for him to be shooting an ILS well above the speeds he's normally practicing.
Yeah. It's like, hey, man, hey, Phoenix, can I get the full procedure into your busiest runway? And they're like, no, you're cleared the visual, dude.
Get out of here. We're gonna check this one off as an ILS for your logbook.
Yeah. So exactly.
Make it happen. Transition to the Viper. How was that for you?
Yeah, I going through the B course at Luke was it was awesome. I mean, went through the 309th. It was it was probably the most fun I've ever had flying. Like, period dot. It was just great, man. The weather's great, the airspace is great, the jets, like, they were old, but like it was during that time when all the D models like were out of commission because they had some Longeron issue or something like that. So I didn't fly like a D model at all in the B course.
Oh, that's amazing.
Dude, so my first flight like in the Viper was single C. And I was like, dude, this is the coolest thing you could ever do in your life. Like, I'm flying an F-16. I have no clue what I'm doing. And I'm doing it like with nobody else. That's amazing.
That's awesome. You know, I was talking. So when I did the demo piece, you know, I was flying a lot of guys and gals in the backseat, putting them through the demo. Most were, yeah, maintainers, maybe some safety observers. But I knew, I remember like one particular, I flew Bender in the backseat. And what, you know, it was like flight control check. I did it differently than the way he did it. Or I did it slightly out of sequence. It's like, oh, I never thought about that. And you know, it's kind of weird. Like, if you think about it, essentially in the B course, well, you know, D model rides, a handful of D model rides, and pass like the first couple ones, the instructor is not saying anything. So if your flow is like a little bit different, no one ever knows the difference. And then it's like, not until you like, very rarely we like, hey, how do you do that or something? Again, there's not that much to it, but it's interesting, like later on down the road, you're like, oh, dude, I never do it that way. But hey, you don't even have that experience.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting to think through that. It's like you're all doing the same mission and you're all, you know, you're on the same page and everything is so like, you know, you spend a lot of time making sure your foreship tactically knows everything, every part of the game plan you're going to execute. But how you get to the actual like vol time or the fights on call, like, is a lot different for, it's different for everybody, you know?
Yeah. Which is, it's kind of wild to think that, but I mean, that's the future. Obviously, the Raptors been doing it for a little while. You know, they were putting their lieutenants through the F-16 for like four or five rides, and they realized, like, well, we don't need to do this. F-35 doesn't even mess with it anymore. So turns out the simulators are good enough and the planes are smart enough to help even guys like me and you figure out how to fly them. Did you want to go to McIntyre? Was that one of your top choices out of the B course?
Yeah. So, it was kind of through that experience of having like what we talked about, like those mentors where they were like, dude, like this, that would be, the Garden Reserve is a great option was kind of, you know, everyone has their own flavor of the day, but it's just a great thing that not a lot of people know about, you know?
Yeah. I guess we should peel that onion back just a little bit because I'm definitely making some assumptions that people understand how the Air Force Garden Reserve works. Can you tell me just a little bit? One, let's start with how did your B course divvy up the assignments? Because I think a lot of people will be interested to know usually how people flow out of the B course to their bases. And then talk to me like TFI and how that piece works.
Yeah. So, I mean, the TFI functionality is something that, you know, the active duty uses to basically integrate the guard and reserve into that like total force concept. So you're going to have active duty, you know, pilots and personnel that are at a guard or reserve base, depending on what type of association it is. And really that's to season some of your younger guys, because there definitely is a lot of experience usually at a guard or reserve base. You know, you got the same, you got a crew chief who's worked on the same jet for like 20 years, which is like unheard of. And so it's a good place to send young talent, like to basically make sure they're being taught the right way. And it's a good way to integrate different perspectives. So, you'll see like McIntyre was a little bit different because we had like, you know, a full squadron of active duty. So there was, you know, 6 to 9 pilots with, you know, 157 maintainers, and they had their own commander, and they all kind of integrated into the structure of the South Carolina Air National Guard, which is cool, man. It definitely brings like a lot of like fresh, it gives that like that fresh blood through the squadron, like where some guard units and some reserve units, you know, you haven't hired a guy in like 10 years and it's like, oh gosh, like the lowest ranking dude here is like an 05, like sweet.
Yeah. Right. They're all weapons officers.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's like, yeah, I know I'm the new guy, and no, I did not fly in Vietnam. So, you know,
right. That's so TFI, total force integration. And again, I think, you know, there's a lot that goes into the Viper, because the Viper, more Vipers flying around probably the world than any other fighter, definitely more in the Air Force, but our Guard and Reserve components typically are hiring guys who have completed their active duty pilot training commitment. So they're like 13 years to their active duty time, but they also hire within. So brand new ones coming off the street. It's like Bogey Dope sponsors this podcast, but you know, those guys kind of help people guide, figure out what units are hiring and how to go through that process. So you can be a brand new dude or dudette that goes that path, but active duty saw, hey, you know, we need to absorb and create more fighter pilots. The Guard and Reserve is a great way to glean some of that experience. How did your B course figure out who's going where? Were you the senior ranking officer?
I was, yeah. So I honestly cannot remember how we did it. Like, it seems like
yours is probably, I mean,
I think we actually did it like in, I don't know if this could be a part of the podcast, dude. I think we did it at like a roll call and it was complete debauchery.
But I mean, I think
like
a lot of people are surprised to find that, like, it depends on the unit and the commander. Like, my commander said, hey, you guys figure it out amongst yourselves. And we were civilized and kind of like everyone wanted something different. So it more or less worked out. Like, there was a little friction, but I mean, it's from dice to paying people off. It's all sorts of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think we did there was some dice involved. There's probably like a bottle of Jack involved, but everyone knew like we had an awesome B course class, dude. I mean, the bros that were in that class most all of them have gone into the F-35, but like everyone we were all good friends, which made, you know, the B course even more enjoyable. Like we'd hang out like outside of just the squadron. Everyone had like a really good bar act, which like, you know, is important as a young lieutenant, to kind of know and want to hang out and like listen to like senior leaders. And we had great IPs. And so I think when it got to that time of figuring out where everyone was going to go, like everyone was just kind of cool with like how the pieces like of the puzzle were coming together. And they were like, yeah, man, like it was no, like everyone wanted Aviano and there was only like one spot type deal. So it ended up working out. Two bros in the class like rolled off dice to see who was going to go to Aviano versus Spangolin. And it was like, all right, whatever.
We had it. I think it was pretty much everyone was set except for two guys. And I forget. I think it came down to some dice and whatever. It worked out in the end, you know. Showed up in McIntyre. So at that time and still is, there was an active duty component already established in McIntyre because I'm trying to think when the TFI kind of sending people to this, it was like, hey, you're the one active duty dude showing up, no real contingent there. And it's kind of grown to more of an established process where you're showing up when it was an active duty squadron that was associated with McIntyre, correct?
Yeah. So I actually, you know, full disclosure on that, like I showed up as a guardsman. So I got out of the active duty right after being a FAPE.
Oh, how'd you do that?
So they were like basically letting people out early. So like I was like, yeah,
no kidding.
And that was kind of the advice I had gotten from some other people were like, dude, there's not a lot of fighters like floating around. I think out of the 10 FAPEs that were in my class, like we had like one or two fighters. And so they're like, you probably have a better shot at being a fighter pilot if you just get out early and try and get a guard job.
While you were a FAPE, were you rushing McIntyre?
I would say like at the very end, I put a resume together, was getting out of the Air Force and went to every single CONUS fighter unit that was guard or reserve and just showed up and was like, hey man, like if you guys are hiring, like I'm already an experienced pilot. All I need to do is like go through the B course or whatever FTU you have, like formal training course. So I was kind of a known quantity and, you know, McIntyre, gave me the opportunity. Like they gave me the shot to basically be a fighter pilot, which was awesome.
That's awesome. I didn't know that. What year was it that, you got out of active duty?
2014.
That's the thing too. You know, the Air Force does these like ebbs and flows with, force shaping and reductions and voluntary separations or force separations. And yeah, I think COVID, it's like, hey, we're good. We got too many people. And that started now, you know, the pendulum has swung back and they're not hitting their recruiting numbers, et cetera. So it's always interesting to hear stories like that. That's cool. Yeah. So definitely a different path than most then.
Yeah, I'd say it's pretty unique.
Was Baldy the same way? I don't want to spoil his episode, but I haven't talked to him yet.
No, he stayed active duty up until I think the 10-year point. Whenever his commitment was done, his full pilot training commitment. But
when you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Our careers still like almost 100% mirrored each other, which is pretty unique as well.
Gotcha. Well, everything I said in the beginning of the episode about, you know, sending a senior guy towards him as pilot training commitment to a TFI squadron, I was surprised. That's now null and void that I figured out you're already out of active duty, but showing up McIntyre, how was that?
It was awesome, man. I mean, McIntyre, the Swamp Fox is, you know, I would say as far as from my perspective, but it's, you know, it's probably not shared by another Block 50, Block 50 dude. Like, it's the best fighter squadron, like, in the CAF, dude. I mean, the level of talent that's there, the level of, like, execution, the level of, like, absolute, like, you know, commitment to making sure that, like, everything is being executed at the highest standard. And so walking into that, like, as a young, you know, I don't know if you know Oscar Meyer, but, like, he's fairly, like, renowned, like, in the Viper community. He told me, like, dude, he swore me in at McIntyre and was basically like, don't screw it up. Like, you know, it's like, all right, man, I'll do my best. And it instills with you, like, at a very, like, young age, relatively speaking, within the jet, like, of how to do things the right way, how to work hard, how to, like, you know, really strive to be better every day that you're flying the Viper.
You know, I'm slightly biased, or maybe it's because I'm, I spent all my Viper time in South Carolina, 10 miles down the road at Shaw. And then I know so many guys in that unit, but a lot of those guys were the ones that kind of shaped and molded my career, you know, like, and so I think it's probably a fair statement to say, you know, I'm just thinking, like, the guys that are in there and, you know, hanging out with last weekend, just how sharp they are and dedicated they are to it, you know, Poker, Hyde, those guys. Poker is my weapons officer on our deployment. Hyde was our wing weapons officer. I think Hyde is, like, the most tactical dude I've ever met and eats, breathes, and lives tactics. But, you know, great dudes. And then, yeah, just everyone else there too. So, yeah, that's a pretty good spot to land, I think, for a dude who's brand new to the Viper and getting molded by some of the best dudes that are out there. That's pretty cool. Where was your first deployment?
So, 2018, we went to Jabber in Kuwait, and we're mainly doing, that was kind of like right at the end of the ISIS, like right before the last, like, push to take out ISIS, but, like, right in the middle time, like, of, hey, everything's starting to wind down. Like, we think we've got this under control. And it was, you know, a lot of the stuff, like, right after the Syrian civil war. So as Russia's moving into that AOR, there was a lot of dynamics going on there for sure, but that was the first one.
I'm trying to think too, the 2018 timeframe, because I was there, you know, 14, 15, not at Jabber, right? But flying the same AO for the most part. Were you guys seeing the Russians? So did they bring in the Su-57? They brought the Su-35s when we were there, which was kind of spicy and at least gained some awareness. But, you know, we had Big Brother Raptor that was hanging out. Were you guys still operating a lot in Syria and Iraq?
Yeah, I mean, that's mainly, we did the most in Syria. Like, we really didn't do a ton in Iraq. It was, you know, kind of the tri-border region between Syria, Jordan, and Iraq. There was, a lot of stuff going on there. And really, you know, you kind of learn the history behind why you're doing some of this, because, you know, that's what a lot of guys are like, oh, I don't even know, like, why we're here. You know, like, why do we care about this? And outside of ISIS, you know, and it's like Syria had just gone through, like, a pretty horrific civil war, where there's definitely a lot of, like, horrible things happening like that. That's what was eye-opening as a relatively young fighter pilot. I think I just upgraded to flight lead before we left. And so it was like, man, I still don't know a lot, but, like, I'm going to lead someone else in combat. And you get over there into that environment and you're like, dude, this is horrible. Like, what is going on, relatively speaking, within the world that most Americans have no clue. You know, one of the missions we had was just to basically cap in this region to protect, like, this refugee camp of 2 million people that had nowhere to go. And it's like, you're looking down, like, down at the ground, and you're like, dude, what in the world is going on, man? At least I can be a part to help, but like still, what in the world is happening? You know,
it's kind of wild. And you think, you know, I showed up in 2014 there, but ISIS was all over the news. So people were aware, but it's not funny, but it quickly drops off the radar and people are focused about, you know, whatever else, gas prices, et cetera. But in 2018, yeah, 4 years later, still to this day, like horrific things are happening and you don't hear about it. Vice News actually did a pretty good documentary and it might have been, I saw about 3 months ago, and the reporter, she was going through some of these refugee camps and this year. And obviously the conditions in those refugee camps are just abysmal. So if I find myself complaining, I can quickly shut myself up. The problem that is there and has always been there and it's going to be there. This reporter, she's Muslim. She's going through and she's interviewing people. The problem in that camp they had were women teaching and indoctrinating young kids into the ISIS ideology, you know, pursuing a path of, you know, going out there and killing the infidels. But this reporter at the end of it closes out and she's maybe like 15, 20 feet away from this group, you know, 8 to 12-year-old boys. And she's asking them questions. So they're shouting kind of back and forth. And, you know, she asks like, would you kill me? And they said, absolutely. Like that's their objective, is to kill her and everyone else that she associates with. And it's kind of scary, but that stuff is, that is going on. The world is obviously not a very happy place. And there's a lot of dynamics going on out there. So it's wild. It's wild to be flying over that.
Yeah. I mean, it was shocking, man. I don't know how many, I don't know what your first like experience was like going into that like part of the world, but I would say it was most shocking for me. It's kind of a funny story. So like I'm part of the AOS, we're flying. We stop in lodges for a night. We take off out of lodges at like 2 a.m, which was, could have been like the scariest thing I've ever done in life, because there was like no stars and it's like complete black, like sea. And so you feel like you're flying into like space. It's like, dude, I have no clue where I'm at. Like, I hope I don't just like, you know, I hope this works out. I need to maintain this radar lock and I hope the sun comes up quick. So we get over the Med and our like third tanker drops out. They're like, oh man, like we're trying to get out of Athens and like we're hard broke, like surprise, right? Yeah. And so the cell lead, Razor Pira, I don't know if you know him, but he's like, all right, boys. He's like, Croc, you start running numbers on gas, make sure we got enough gas to get to, you know, our missed refueling base. He's like, but it's going to come down to either Suda Bay or Sigonella. So let's start talking. Who wants to go to Italy? Who wants to go to Greece? And dude, we all had the expectation that we were going to be landing in like the middle of the desert and like going to like some horrible, like, you know, little like, you know, trailer to live or sleep that night. And now we're making this really tactical decision of Italy or Greece. There's a lot of consternation, dude, but we basically decide we're going to Suda Bay because it was the European spring break, which was really the driving factor.
Problem solved.
It's
good SA on that time.
Yeah, exactly. And so we land and we call back to the squadron commander and great gun story too. Like he's the weapons officer leading the squadron into like this deployment. So they've been ADVON. They've been there for like 3 weeks. And it was like they're basically like sandstorm season. So like they were sending pictures out on these group chats of like these horrific sandstorms, dude. Like you couldn't even drive. And we call back and we're like, oh man, like we missed our tanker. And sure enough, like the youngest dude in the squadron posts on the same chat where everyone's like complaining about how horrible it is, this picture of like the beach. we ended up being there for like six to nine days because they couldn't find another tanker. So then the cell takes off to finally join the fight. And my fuel gauge doesn't work as we're starting up. And so it was like a food fight between like two of the more senior dudes who's staying back like with Croc. And sure enough, it was Nasty Beckham. He's like, he wins the little like Rochambeau. And so we stayed like in Suda Bay for like a whole nother like 10 days. It was insane, man. Dude. It was like the first like half of my deployment was there. Not realistically, but it was a while. So we take off. I'd gotten used to beach life by then, man. Like we were loving life.
Yeah. That's
and the great. Rest of the squadron's just, you know, like hating everything that's happening. And so we finally take off out of Suda Bay, man. And we, I'll never forget it, man. We're holding 50 miles north of the base as one of these epic sandstorms are coming through. We're holding like basically in IFR conditions for sand. And I remember asking like Nasty, I'm like, dude, what is happening? And he's like, our lives just got 100% worse, dude. And like, you're looking out and like, as a dude who'd never been in that part of the world, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is horrible.
That's brutal. That's like, hey, welcome. Especially like ripping the Band-Aid off. I would say I flew over on the AOS, not the AOS bird. I flew, you know, the 747 or whatever.
You got rotated
for our deployment. Yeah, the rotator. I was like, what is that thing we got? Blank there. We had two jets, Tactical and Von Finkenstadt. They got stuck on the AOS movement in Rota. And they got stuck because Israeli overflight. Like it took like 14 days to get their dip clearances. But meanwhile, it is like, I mean, we are full on. Everyone is coming back, cleaning the rails, every single sortie. And they're just like seeing it in the group chat. I think Tack went into depression and then he gets there and he is like the one dude just wrong place, wrong time for like the first like five sorties or something. Like he has not dropped the bomb, you know? And like that's what we had. It was a belt of shame, which is probably highly inappropriate, but it was the last person to drop to have not dropped. You had to wear this like pink reflective belt, walk around the base. It was just crazy. I mean, it was a crazy time, different times. And so he was stuck with that belt for a little bit. But he did get to enjoy Spain for a little bit. That sounds like Suda Bay was a better choice for you guys.
Dude, we were sitting on the beach, Nasty and I, and just hanging out. And I was like, man, I am so ready to get out of here. I was like, dude, I want to be like with the bros. I want to be like flying like combat lines every day. They were doing like a decent amount. It wasn't like quite like what you're describing, but they were still like doing stuff. And I'm like, dude, I'm so ready. And he looked at me and he's like, Croc, this is probably going to be the most epic vacation of your life. The war can wait. And I was like, no, you don't get it, man. And he's like, dude, you're an idiot. Like, this is awesome. Like where we're at is awesome.
Yeah. Grow where you're planted, man. That's awesome. Did you guys had 90 days there, right? But was that the one with the windstorm that did a bunch of damage to the jets?
Yeah, so that was to Duluth. That happened right before we showed up. That was bad, man. I don't know how they got all the jets like back out of there, but like I think it was like basically putting, you know, pieces of airplanes back onto like a C-17 to bring home to put back together type deal. That happened like right as we were showing up, and the sandstorms there were horrible, man. I don't know if you've ever been to Jabber, but like it was an old, well, it still is a Kuwaiti like Air Force base, but it was one of the ones that Saddam bombed like right as Gulf War was starting. So you would drive past like all these like huge houses, man, and you could see like these huge like they bombed out sections of them, and really what had happened is Saddam took over that Air Force base with force, and then I'm pretty sure that was one of the first strikes that F-117s did, and they dropped, you know, like all these bombs like basically to take out Saddam's like Air Force. It was kind of cool, man. There was a lot of history there, and it was a decent place like to fly out of.
Yeah, were you pretty busy during that time period?
Yeah, we were. I mean, like you think about like right where the Euphrates like comes into Iraq and goes back up into Syria. We were really busy, like kind of all throughout that area. You know, there was a lot of I would say a lot of like different dynamics. It was also like Russia was there, so you had like a pretty complicated complicated decision matrix, like to really like describe it in the best layman's terms, as far as like, hey, you see something bad, like here's, you know, 20 different ways you could handle this situation depending on who that is. And I was like, oh my gosh, dude, like there's a lot of different like political and like socioeconomic dynamics going on in that part of the world for sure.
Yeah, between the Kurds, the Turks, the Syrians, the Russians, us, the Iranians, like there's a lot of dynamics. It's just waiting to boil over. It's a spicy place to be involved for sure. I always said too, you know, like flying over the Euphrates, I don't know, it's varies, but especially up like in Syria, like near Kobani, my solution to all this was like, you just drop a bunch of jet skis on the Euphrates. It's so beautiful flying over that. Like it'd be so epic. And who can be angry on a jet ski? I can't tell me one person, you know?
Yeah, I don't know who would be, man. But like, so we were flying. It was one night we were out there, and it was like a mix of like, you would do a mix of like DCA. And you do like a little bit of like, you know, hey, we're watching the Russians, they're watching us. And then we kind of got like this, you know, no fly zone type deal going. And then you would do, you know, like a decent amount of CAS, which is, you know, what we were doing to support the JTACs as we were trying to take out ISIS. And so we were out there, it was like, you know, 2-3 in the morning, and like everyone's kind of bored and there's not like a lot going on. One of the JTACs is like, dude, you want to see something that's like pretty epic? And I'm like, well, like epic as far as like, you want to like do something like cool, or like, do I just want to see something cool? He's like, no, like it'll actually make you laugh, but like in the next week, we're going to like basically take all this out. So you get to see it like before it happens. I'm like, all right, cool. He's like, all right, here's the coordinates. And we get the targeting pods on them. And so there, it's like this row down this dirt road right outside the city. It's just a row of like probably half a mile of like washing machines. And I'm like, are those washing machines? And he's like, yeah, man, they are. Isn't that cool? And I'm like, what? He's like, dude, they're loading these washing machines up with like explosives, and they're going to basically like line them along these roads and use them as like IEDs. And I'm like, what? Like, that's pretty strange. So he's like, well, the better question is, it's like, where do you find a washing machine in this part of the world? And I'm like, that's valid, man. Like,
that's also a great question.
I didn't see any like, you know, Sears up the road, you know, it's like, where'd they find like 69 washing machines?
I remember flying over. I didn't talk to someone who actually got involved in the Mosul offensive. When we were there, we dropped a couple bombs like on the outskirts, and it looked like it was just kind of heating up. And it might have been the 14th or the shooters after them. We would just fly over Mosul, and they were just building. It was all day long, just with excavators and bulldozers building a berm around the entire city, which is a big city. So, but I also was like, you know, we're like flying over you. Like, it's not the medieval times of building a dam and stuff. So like, there's just some like weird things that would go on for sure.
Yeah. I've never understood like hiding under a tree. Like, I guess that kind of helps, but it's like, it's not going to like, the tree's not going to do much for you, dude. Like my first drop was like on a mortar team that was like, you know, there was like, it was basically a mortar team that was lobbing mortars into this like US coalition outbase FOB, so to speak. And like, as soon as you could tell that they heard us, and we're still, you know, like 25,000 feet, but they could hear like jets. And so they literally like pick up this mortar tripod, and they move it like 2 feet under this tree. And like the dude kind of looks up and he's like, yeah, like you're never going to find me now type deal. And it's like, bro, I'm like literally one radio call from like dropping two of these JDAMs and you're going to be smoked. Like that tree's not going to do anything. It was, and we ended up dropping on them and taking them out, which was cool to see an instant impact, like on your first drop. Like you can hear the dude on the radio in the fob. Like you can hear like the sirens going off type deal. You know who's doing it. And it's like, okay, I get to be a part of this kill chain and the tree's not going to save you.
Yeah. It's just going to give me a mark to really help to make sure I don't miss you. Yeah. Did you do Afghanistan too in a deployment or?
So that was the last one that we were on. So we went back to the same AO, different base, 2 years later. So 2020, and we were doing all the same areas and Afghanistan at the same time. And that was kind of right during the heart of the pull out, so to speak, from Afghanistan. So it was the last, couple of days that guys were in Afghanistan trying to get out of there.
How was that? That had to be some emotions involved with it, but also kind of, I mean, yeah, different time. I imagine the ROEs are probably pretty restrictive. There's some question marks over your guys' heads.
Yeah. I mean, that was rough, man. I think it was sad in my mind. I'll give you my personal opinion. It was sad to see, something. It's almost like watching like a dude like on his flug upgrade and you sit through the brief and you're like, dude, this is never going to work. And then you see him like trying to execute it in the air and it's almost like painful to watch. You're like, oh my gosh, dude, this is horrible. And it's just, you're like losing hardcore. It was like, that's the only analogy I could think of, like from a fighter pilot term, man. Like it was just, there was nothing that was like going right on with it, And it was like, come on, man, like we could do better than this. And you didn't have a clear cut answer as to why it was like going so poorly,
Were you guys there like during August, like the last final days, or were you just there the last couple months?
I think we were there in July.
Yeah. You guys are. Yeah. Right there at the end. It's so frustrating to see how that went down, but.
Yeah, it really is. And it's a long time to sit in a single seat airplane, man. That would be the negative personally. Professionally, the negative is how poorly it all went,
Yeah, absolutely. On the personal note, what was that trek? Because you guys had to come up the boulevard, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, you fly all the way around Iran and then, go up north, like to hit Afghanistan, it was like, I want to say like 4-ish hours. So, I mean, you'd be showing up and you're like, oh gosh, man, like, I've already burned breakfast, lunch, and I'm like working on, my dinner snacks. And like, I got no more piddle packs. Like, dude, this is going to go really poorly. I'm not even halfway through this deal.
How long were your vols up there? If you're flying 4 hours there, 4 hours back.
I think they were typically like 2 hours, depending on like if you got extended or anything like that. So, I mean, it was, oh man, this is like, it's a long day and a lot of go pills, man.
Yeah. Was it kinetic there in those last couple months?
Not at all.
Yeah.
Which was the other sad part. I mean, you just saw the Taliban like taking over stuff that like we'd spent, the past 20 years of our, blood, sweat, and tears trying to help this country stand stuff up. And you saw it just being like, overrun. And you were just like, there wasn't much to do, which that sucked,
Yeah. The only positive I've heard out of this, because it's pretty depressing, at least for me, and I think a lot of people, like 2 decades and this is what it comes to. But the one positive was from a retired Green Beret, and he said, held the space for 20 years, which hopefully will afford opportunity for people to resist. But man, there's some heinous stuff that is going on still to this day and will go on for a long time. If it's not interrupted, it's frustrating. But again, here we are.
Yeah, there's it is frustrating. I would say that.
I hate to end on like that type of note. I always ask my guest, Croc, if you found like 15, 16 year old you, maybe I need to back that up to like 12 or 13 based on the fact that at 15 you had an internship in a fighter squadron. Is there any advice you would give him, tell him to do something different, change things up?
I would say one of the biggest lessons that I feel like I still am learning like consistently, like through life, is to never like never judge something too quickly and make a decision like in haste based off your initial judgment. And so, you know, I would say that's something that like I'm still learning how to do. Like before you fully commit like to something, or you fully like make a decision on what the situation is, make sure you have like all the facts and you've given yourself the opportunity to like process that. I don't know if 12-year-old Croc would have like really understood that. He probably would have been like, all right, that sounds dumb. However, it's a lot of like knowing as a fighter pilot, you know, this, like there's definitely like some things you do really quickly. At times there's decisions you need to make really fast, but there's also like a high level of like being patient and like waiting, like almost like cold ops, man, like getting into cold ops and just saying, all right, like let's take time. Let's figure out like what the problem is that we're about to solve. Be patient and then make a decision as to what the right choice is.
Yeah, absolutely. Easier said than done. And you're not the first person to say, I don't know if like 12 or 13 year old Croc would actually listen. So I think that's kind of fair as well, but you never know. That's not an easy thing too, is just be patient, assess information and make, you know, a timely decision based upon the environment you're in. So cold ops is a good expression, a good way of describing that. And again, for those who don't know, there's a lot that goes into that hot and cold ops, but he's talking air to air, hot when you're pointing at the enemy, slinging missiles, cold ops. You got your back turned to them, letting the picture settle out, figuring out what the problem is behind you, and then turning in and handling the problem there. So I think that's good. You know, Croc, I did, as I was thinking, with asking that, I should have teed it up. So I failed you to like give you like a little warning there, but it's always fun to do that. We didn't really talk about the foundation. We have a lot of podcast episodes that are going to talk about the foundation. Can you real quick kind of maybe talk about your background with guns and what led to creating the foundation?
Yeah. So, I mean, Guns Garen was, he's the first person I met when I got out to McIntyre. So we quickly, you know, you could probably relate with that, Rain, like where there's like, you know, certain personalities like within a fighter squadron that you mesh with like kind of instantly. And you're like, hey, like we're not only going to be like, you know, good, professional, like friends, like at work, but like, we're going to probably hang out on the weekends and like, you know, throw some beers back and talk about life. And so Guns was one of those friends, like to a lot of people within this squadron, but, he was, you know, a graduated weapons school, instructor and highly talented and very dedicated to like the Swamp Fox in general, and to his family even more so than that. And so in 2020, he had some medical complications with a procedure that he had gotten done for AFib, which was kind of a weird time in our squadron because there were a lot of guys that were dealing with like that AFib, like kind of heart thing. And so he went and got the procedure done and got sick, man. And he passed away like in the midst of like COVID, like the worst days. And so, you know, I tell a lot of people that ask me about the foundation, like that's the background of like how we get to like the start of where we are now, which is like his sudden passing and looking at that tragedy. And that was really the first person that I had in my life that I was really close to outside of family that I had seen pass away. And in that really all out of nowhere, man. I mean, it's like we were just hanging out 2 days ago and like you're gone. I'll never forget it, man. Like Baldy and I were the mayor scribe duo. And I'll tell you, like, I'm going to be humble. Like, I was a pretty good scribe and Baldy was like a fairly average mayor. Now I say that because it was probably the worst combination you could have because I'm fairly like, you know, I don't got a lot of emotion going on here. And it's like, all right, recap the story. And it's like, I don't know, man, that was a horrible story. Like, what do you want me to tell you? No recap, you know, like, so we're about to kick off this epic naming and Guns was honestly supposed to be there. And, I'll never forget it, man. The squadron commander walked in and he's like, dude, roll call's canceled. Naming's canceled. The flight doc got up and was like, hey, you know, Guns was hospitalized today. We don't know why. We're trying to figure out what's going on and keep him in your thoughts and prayers. And you could just feel, you know, leading up to a roll call, like emotion is at like, you know, 169%. And then the room just like dropped. They were like, holy, like, what is going on? And that was just him getting hospitalized. That's the effect that he had like on the squadron. So, you know, the realization was the outcome. There's certain things in life that you can't control. And as a fighter pilot, you think that you can control everything. And that was really the first time as well, where it was like, dude, there are just things in life that are out of my hands. And his passing away, there's nothing that any of us could have done about it. Like it was his, you know, I guess, you know, his time to go, even though it was way too early, you know? And so I asked myself, like, what can I do? What is within my control? And what I can do is make sure that his legacy lives on, but even more so, I can help make sure that like military members who are going through tough times, have support, whether it's just someone standing beside him and saying, hey, I support you, or it's helping them financially. And so that's why we started the foundation. We started it to help military members and veterans who are going through a hard time. You call it the worst time of their life, or just maybe they're struggling to make ends meet. We want to be that helping hand and help serve them and make sure that they know that they're not alone. So, you know, it's our second year, a little over second year of running this thing. It's been really honestly humbling and encouraging to see not only people's support, like financially for the foundation, but then to be able to turn around and be able to help people that are going through some really hard times in life. And, to be able to tell like the story of Guns to those people is pretty powerful as well.
Yeah, it's huge. I was honored to just be up there for the golf tournament and see what you guys have done in such a short time span. I would say it's impressive. It's not surprising that a bunch of fighter pilots were able to come together and solve some complex problems and put some things together that are completely out of your wheelhouse. Cause I doubt you went to school to be how to stand up a foundation, but I saw the impact that you've had just in such a short period of time. And I think it's important to hit on like, yeah, helping veterans out in their time of need. And fortunately, we're in a society where I think that gets thrown out there a good bit. There are a lot of foundations out there that are doing things, but you guys have kept your bylaws, I think, rather open so that you're not pigeonholed into this specific criteria set has to be met in order to help a veteran out in need, which is pretty awesome. Can you talk a little bit, I guess, kind of what the foundation really can do and where you think it might be going?
Yeah. So I'm glad that you brought that up. So you see, there's a lot of, one of the things that was frustrating to me, like as I started thinking about like really getting into this like space, so to speak, was like, there's a lot of people that like, when it's convenient, say like, oh yeah, like we're all about the military, man. Like we're all about like supporting veterans, and it's like lip service. And it's like, do you know, are you going to put like any weight behind those words is a really good way to put it. And so when we were making those bylaws and we were figuring out like, hey, what are we going to do and how are we going to do it? What we were adamant about doing is making sure that we gave ourselves the flexibility to be able to like really put like some weight behind the fact that we said like we are going to help people out when they need help. And it would be foolish of us to think that we could tell the future and know like, hey man, we know veterans are only going to be needed to help and helped in this way. And so this is what we're going to say we're going to do. So we did give ourselves a lot of flexibility. We can help like anyone who's been in the military, anyone who currently is in the military, or any family member. And so that looks like a lot of different things for a lot of different people. But what it consistently looks like is a need is brought to us from within that community. And we have the flexibility to say like, yes, we are 100% behind helping you get through this time or helping meet that need. So that looks like, you know, stuff we're doing right now, buying groceries for a family to try and help meet ends. We're helping pay a mortgage for someone who's going through a really hard time. We've helped with funeral costs. We've helped with just financial aid in general of people that are coming back from a deployment and maybe like their finance like is all screwed up and they're not getting paid correctly. They've reached out and said, hey, could you help? Servicemen who are either currently deployed or like coming back from a deployment and maybe they're not getting paid correctly, we can step in and say, all right, like we're going to make sure we're doing that right now. Like honestly, for quite a few military members who just got back from being deployed, their pay system is kind of screwed up and they're worried about getting their families through the holidays, man. Like that's what they're worried about. They're like a 20-year-old airman who doesn't make like money to begin with. And now they're not getting paid. And it's like, yeah, that's a travesty that like the system is set up that way, or there's a failure of the system, but like I can help just ease the pain, man. And that's the thing that like we're really committed to is so often in the military, you're taught like to show strength no matter what. So it could be the worst situation ever. And you're going to be strong, man. Like you're going to execute the mission, which I think is good. But at the same time, like it's okay to like ask for help, and it's okay to say like, hey, I need help to get through this time in my life. And then for us to be the organization that is right there to say like, we are going to help and we're committed to helping you is really cool. It is one of the coolest things that I've done up until this point in my life is saying, I'm going to start a foundation that's dedicated just to giving to people who are in hard times of need. And really it's the whole squadron has been a huge part of what we're doing. So it's not just me doing it.
No, I know it's definitely a team effort, but it's really cool to see what you guys have been able to accomplish and just actually see and meet people who are on the receiving end, who are going through a tough time that you guys have been able to help out. If people, one, either need help or two, they just want to get involved with the foundation, what's a good way for them to find out more info or get involved?
Yeah, so if it's someone that needs help or someone that wants to give, the easiest way to do that is to go to GunsGarin.com. You can see the work that we're doing on social media at GunsGarin, Instagram, Facebook. We've got a YouTube channel, but you can see really the easiest way to stay in tune with what we're doing is to follow us on Instagram or Facebook and then go to the website. You click, if you need help, you click the apply for aid and tell us who you are and what you need. And we usually get monetary funds back out to people within 24 to 48 hours. And then if you want to donate, you just hit the donate button on the website. And, we encourage people to be a monthly giver. And, you know, I know times are tight, but really, even if it's just $5 or $10 a month that you can say, hey, man, like I'm going to help these guys on a monthly basis, be consistent. That can help us give consistently to the people who are in need.
Yeah, it's awesome stuff. So again, this is slightly out of order for the normal podcast, but again, this is, you know, it's good to hear Croc, your background, your story and kind of how you flow into this. But I think it's such an awesome thing you guys are doing. That's why we're doing so many episodes around essentially centered around the foundation and what you guys may be able to accomplish and go out there and honor guns and help a lot of people out. So I really appreciate it. any parting shots before we separate here?
No, I mean, we thank, as a foundation, we thanks for getting the word out and giving us the opportunity to just tell people about what we're doing. And then, you know, thanks for what you're doing, for helping, you know, people tell their stories. So we've enjoyed it.
Awesome. Croc, I really appreciate it, man.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you want to learn more about Guns, Gear, and Memorial Foundation, or if you want to join us at Sun to Fun, click the links down below and hopefully see you at the end of March. The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns, Gear, and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain.
Good news, bad news. All those spam and text calls you've been getting lately? Well, that's a result of your information having been sold by third-party data brokerages, or it's been stolen and sold to nefarious people. Ticketmaster recently had a data breach where 560 million users' information was stolen and sold in the dark web. This included their names, physical addresses, email addresses, credit card information, and much more. Best case scenario, this just ends with more annoying phone calls and text messages. Worst case, it's going to end in fraud and you're really going to be in the hurt locker. That's why I've been using a service called Aurora for over a year now. I've talked about it on the podcast before, but not only do they monitor the dark web and the internet for my information in case it is involved in a breach, they go right to work removing your information from these data brokerages. When I signed up, they identified over 60 that had my information and went right to work removing me from these data brokerages. Now, yep, you could do this yourself, but each one of these data brokerages has its own policies and procedures, and I have no idea how you would even start trying to remove yourself from these services, let alone how much time that would take. But Aurora does that, as well as they offer a whole suite of tools to keep you safe, including a VPN, antivirus, password management, parental controls, and identity theft insurance. You get this all in one app, one place, so it's super simple. And you can do this with a 14-day risk-free trial. Super simple. And if you don't like it, you just cancel anytime. It's not complicated. At a minimum, you can take a look and see what information of yours is out there lurking on the web right now. Use the link down below in the description or go to aurora.com/afterburn and you get 14 days risk-free, cancel anytime, super easy, and take the first step in protecting yourself out there on the interwebs. That's the good news, by the way.
Complete your staining project with Pittsburgh Paints and Stains, now at Menards. Stain in one coat with Ultra Advanced Semi-Transparent Stain. It's a stain and sealant in one that can be applied to damp wood and on hot, sunny days, allowing you to clean and stain your deck in one day. Save big money on Pittsburgh Paints and Stains and head into Menards to get your staining project started today. Save big money
at Menards. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.